Yes, you are on the seventh day of SMARTIST 2008 and the fifth and last day of our keynote presentations. We'll have Michael Woodward today, Jennifer Loudon, and Eric Mazel. I am Ariane Goodwin, your host and moderator for the annual SMARTIST Art Career Conference. If you want to keep track of SMARTIST, visit us at www.smartist-telesummit.com. That's S-M-Artist, A-R-T-I-S-T dash tele, T-E-L-E, summit, S-U-M-M-I-T. Today we will have the last three of our 13 keynote experts for this year. We're going to hear Michael Woodward and Jennifer Loudon back-to-back, and then we'll take a 15-minute break, which so far this week has never been 15 minutes, but we'll shoot for it today, and then we're going to return for Eric Mazel. But first, I want to take a moment to acknowledge two things. I want to acknowledge the courage and the commitment it has taken for every one of you to sign up for this intensive course of study, which is what SMARTIST really is in the first place. And then I want to congratulate you for moving through the challenges that always get invited into your living room when you open the door to change. Challenges come in all sizes, from mini frustrations to what looks like impossible hurdles. What I've seen here at SMARTIST is how many of you are consciously choosing to use each challenge as the invitation it truly is to focus on what you want most. For it is only and ever what we bring our intentions and attentions to that flower and bloom. If you have joined us, you are on it, the seventh day of SMARTIST 2008. It's our wrap-up day, and we're going to have keynote presentations with Michael Woodward, Jennifer Loudon, and Eric Mazel. I am so thrilled that our first guest today is Michael. You've agreed to return to SMARTIST for the second year in a row, Michael.
Absolutely.
Here's a man who has been in the art licensing industry for over 30 years and was one of the original pioneers forming the first art licensing company in Europe back in 1979. And his presentation today, The Changing Face of Licensing, will leave you with more and better ways to cope with the challenges of the art world. Michael, where can SMARTISTs find you on the web?
They can find me at licensingcourse.com.
And
that's my educational site. And then my agency is outoftheblue.us, but it's hyphenated. So out-of-the-blue.us.
Great. So there's two websites that Michael does. One is educational, and one is for his art licensing agency. So both of those will get you to him. Michael, I'll be looking for questions that might come in while you talk, and if there are more, I'll pop back in a few minutes early.
Great. Yeah, and I've got some few questions already. So,
yeah, you've got some juicy ones on your plate today.
Too juicy. I think it took an hour to answer that one. But
oh, my goodness. All right. Oh, SMARTIST, you are going to get so much today. Michael, it's all yours. I'm going to pop off and listen with the rest of them, and I'll be back before the end.
Okay, thank you. Well, hello. I'm Michael Woodward. As Ariane said, I've been in the industry for a very long time. And I normally do a lecture or a talk about licensing and the nitty-gritty, but today I'm going to do something very different. And I've called it The Changing Face of Licensing, learning how to navigate the new landscape. And so what I'm then going to do is I'm going to basically help you through this, navigate you through this new landscape, because it's very, very different from what it used to be when I started in 1974. Which is over 30 years ago. And what I'm going to then do, I'm going to try and get some questions that have come in over the last week and try and answer them. So they're very specific then about things that people want to know. So one of the things that, I've realized is how amazing the world has changed. It's only a few years ago that artists used to work directly with publishers and manufacturers, producing finished art on artboard, canvas, they either took into the client in person or sent via mail. Many publishers worked often with artists in their own neighborhoods or, in the adjacent states, but at least within driving distance. And this seems so distant now, but it's actually only 10, 15 years ago when this is what happened. So technology has changed everything in our lives. We now buy online more often than not, when only a few years ago there was a huge fear of buying anything on the internet. I now buy insurance, I buy shoes, clothing, ink cartridges, computers, and even pay my bills online. It actually simplifies many time-consuming tasks, leaving us more free time. But for what? The problem seems to me at the moment that most of us are spending that time learning how to use the internet for our businesses and more efficiently, and because there's so much to learn. So particularly licensing has changed, and agencies now have whole libraries available on the web. Artists submit to clients via email. Manufacturers have online stores allowing you to shop in the privacy of your own home, naked even, if you so desire. One factor, however, is that it creates a more level playing field, and that allows anyone, anywhere, in most cases, to compete with each other. Nowhere more so than in the licensing industry. One of the key factors is the way the internet has changed the way we do business. And this book by Thomas Friedman, The World is Flat, gives a totally different picture of how business is conducted through outsourcing, internet stores, and a myriad of other factors which have rapidly changed the way businesses operate throughout the world. So the idea of this talk is to bring you up to speed on how publishers and manufacturers have adjusted their way of working due to the changes brought about through this digital revolution. So, we're going to first look at how the internet has changed everything and how it affects artists and photographers. And I'm going to use fine art publishing as an example, and some examples sort of relate to other industries, but this is a good one to use as an example. Now, in the past, publishers of fine art produced printed glossy catalogs of all their posters, often with additional supplements throughout the year. They still do that to a certain extent, but this is how the whole business operated in the early days. They attended trade shows like Art Expo in New York, mainly sold their products to galleries, frame shops, and a small percentage to mass market framers. So what happened over the past 10 years is these large box companies, i.e. the mass market high street retailers like Bed Bath, Linens and Things, Target, Kirkland's, Pottery Barn, Ballard's, etc. They all moved into selling art as home decor products. The buying power of these companies, who buy in large quantities, allows them to demand lower prices from suppliers. So this, in turn, created large framing operations to cater for the demand that these giant retailers had. And as the demand for cheaper and cheaper prices increased, which is inevitable, this created the need for suppliers of canvas prints and frames to seek cheaper prices and production costs in China and Mexico. Some of these Chinese factories, you know, people get worried about China, but they've been producing work for many, 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 many years. And when they first started producing, you know, products for the fine art market, they were pretty horrendous, done on very cheap canvas or very cheap paper. The printing wasn't so good. But as the technologies got better, and people like HP, people like Epson, have bought out cheaper and cheaper machines that are not the $50,000, $60,000 machines, but down to $15,000, $20,000. It's allowed and the quality's gone up. It's allowed the Chinese to really, really produce very, very saleable product. And I've seen some of these products in publishers when I traveled to California, and I saw, I think it was a 4 foot by 3 foot canvas, and the client said to me, "What do you think I paid for that?" And I said, "Well, maybe, you know, $70, $80 if it's China, $19 Now, that really floored me. You couldn't get that printed here for less than $70, $80, probably more at most places, probably $150. But with that kind of product coming in from China, you can start to see how it's affected the whole industry. So galleries and frame shops can now no longer compete at this level. Many of them went out of business as these big box guys swamp the market, and they are. If you walk into any Bed Bath & Beyond now, or Linens and things, you'll see canvas in there, you'll see framed art in there. And if you went into a frame shop to buy a frame and had it, a big picture framed, you couldn't buy the frame for less money than you could buy this framed art product in the store. In other words, the frame will cost you more. So you get the canvas and the frame for less money than you can get a picture framed in a frame shop. And some of the quality is very, very good. Very elaborate framing with slip mounts and gold foil and so on. So some of you might say, well, this is home decor, particularly the fine artists. And that's true. But the thing is that more and more people now are buying art for their walls. And if you've got a product out there, which is $100, $150, and it looks good to them, then you can see where the market shifted. And people who may have spent a little bit more, you know, in the few years ago, now they can see this product coming out, which looks good to their eye, and some of the products is good. Those prices make a huge difference when somebody's actually trying to buy a particular product. Now, there's another key factor, which I need to tell you about, which has had a huge impact on the industry, and that was the Home Decor TV series. Now, I believe it started in the UK, and one program called Changing Rooms became a huge success, spawning many spin-off programs. If you look on the, I think it's HDD, I can't remember, it's a Home Decor channel anyway, you'll see, I don't know, five, six, seven, eight programs on there, all about designing rooms. Now, I'll give you the idea of what happened in England and the changing rooms. It's called changing rooms. And two top designers helped two couples redesign rooms for each other in their respective homes. So the designers introduced innovative contemporary decorating ideas as well as contemporary artwork. And what happened is that each couple, with the help of the designer, redesigned part of the house. And hopefully the other couple, their friends, liked it. I think some of them fell out with each other after the program, but that's another story. But what happened is over the last few years, these contemporary decorating ideas and these contemporary artworks have been brought into these design programs, abstract particularly, which normally the general public weren't into abstract. That was in the fine art market. Now you'll see abstract work in regular households. And it's the influence of these programs that's actually made that happen. And a lot of people don't realize that. Why suddenly are people buying abstract? You walk into Bed Bath & Beyond, you'll see abstract work on the walls. And you'd have never seen that five, six, 7 years ago. So this introduction to design has perhaps been the biggest influence on the public at large, as program after program filled our screens about home decor and design ideas. And once you start to understand that, you see now this picture emerging of why the market's changed so drastically. Now, digital technology has allowed huge internet portals to flourish, like art.com. There are others like posters.com, old posters, and so on. There's many, many of them. But art.com is the biggest, and it's where anyone can simply go online and choose from tens of thousands of artworks from a little of $10 to a few hundred dollars. Now, on there, you've got Picasso's, you've got Kandinsky, you've got all the major, you know, like Monet's, all the old masters, and you've got lots and lots of modern works. You've got a lot of posters and prints that, again, $10, $15, $20. To canvases, which are a few hundred dollars. Now, you can choose a frame, and you can have it shipped direct to your door, which makes that far, far easier. And, you know, many thought this idea wouldn't work out, but they were wrong. I think one of the reasons was the choice that you have online is so vast. You think about going out and finding, you know, 10,000 pieces of artwork to review. It'd take you weeks looking around all the stores. So by going online, you can see everything. The quality is the same as you'd see in a store. And as long as you're buying a print or a canvas, it's not an original, then, you know, the generally quality is good and it's backed by a guarantee. So you're pretty safe working with a company like this to buy it online. So literally, you can save yourself, you know, hours and hours and hours of shopping by just shopping online. Now, besides the choice being a good factor, it's this huge diversity. And what's happened is many other websites have sprung up, not just selling posters, but also high-end limited editions. And original works of art have started to appear on the internet these last few years, and believe it or not, people are buying original works of art. Now, it shocked me a few months ago, I approached an interior design company here locally, and just for some research, and I said, you know, where do you buy the bulk of your art for the projects you're working on? And this was for, say, a hospital. One was for a boardroom, one was for a reception area. And I was shocked to find they bought probably 80% of what they buy is on art.com. And that is a major interior design company in town here. They obviously, when they want originals and they want something special, they go outside of that and they'll approach local artists and they'll approach galleries and so on. But for general projects where they need a print, and it's got to be like, you know, 150 or less framed, then art.com is the place where many designers are actually using. Now, many sites have started a new thing, which I'm going to be talking about quite a little bit, and it's called Print On Demand, P-O-D. And you're going to hear that word bandied around a lot. It's relatively new phenomena, and I say relatively new, I mean it's been going on for a few years, but it's only this last year or two that the big publishers who have been sort of, their margins have been so diluted by these big box companies demanding such low prices that they've all decided that they've got to do something different to survive. And the print-on-demand business model has emerged. And this is where artwork is produced digitally with the latest inkjet machines. And these are produced by Roland, Hewlett-Packard, Epson. They're the main players. And these machines, they're from 50, 60,000 down, and right down to, you know, machines which artists can actually buy for just $2,000 or $3,000. But this not only allows designers in the hospitality industry to order prints to their own size and specification, it also allows the public the same privilege. This print on demand is really where a website portal is created, where the artwork is shown. Various sizes can be already up there with the prices. And then this custom button, which you can press, which allows you to put in your own sizes on some of the sites and say, because you want it very specifically. Particularly designers, they might want something that's a funny size, you know, like 23 by 23. And digital technology allows you to actually print to whatever size you wish. This also means that there's no inventory. And again, I'm going to talk a little bit about that later on. Let me see. Some of these machines are at a level which allows artists and photographers to even produce their own digital prints. So giclées being the term most used, which can be on a high-level quality art paper, can be on canvas. There are all kinds of different substrates now that are coming onto the market. So, and some publishers are even producing work on fabric. So this actually allows for a whole new, sort of this technology to be used online for the interior design business, hospitality industry, as well as self-publishing. So what do we learn from all this? We learn that digital technology is very advanced now. And basically, one of the things I want to really get across to you is that you must become technologically proficient. It's pretty obvious that unless you've got a computer, an email, an ability to surf the web, that you might as well be living on the moon if you haven't mastered the initial stages. Many artists now have their own websites and self-publish. Many of you, I hope, are mastering sending email submissions, sending CD portfolios to clients, and are using the technology to further your careers. In my own business, and most others, I now would not consider an artist these days unless they're proficient in digital technology. This applies to most industries, greetings cards, calendars, stationery, coasters, floor mats, bookmarks. I mean, these days, artists in most cases are also expected to provide the digital files for printing. And I'm amazed at the number who still have very little knowledge of how this works. So it's essential that you learn about TIFF files and reproduction methods so you can supply high-quality files for printing. One artist sent me JPEGs last week for printing a fine art poster, 36 by 24, which is impossible. I mean, you just can't use JPEGs for printing at that kind of quality. And recently, to my horror, two artists who I represented had all their work rejected by a major publisher owing to supplying material that was substandard. As when it blew up to 40 inches, the image started to pixelate. So the lesson here is learn about printing technology sufficiently so you know what you need to supply, especially for the fine art market. Check your files before sending them out, and if possible, print out a piece or a section, you know, if you print a small, but the size it's going to print. So obviously, if you can't print it 36-24, you take a small section, blow that up to what it would look like, and see what it looks like. If you're not doing that, you're not doing your job properly. And with this print-on-demand technology, when that file goes to the publisher, it sits there. They don't check every single file because they get thousands in. They sit there. And basically, when it comes time to print it, you've just got to hope that that prints well. And we're making new rules now about accepting certain TIFF files and having artists to check them and sending proofs with the actual CDs. Now, presentations. That's what the next thing I'm going to talk about, how it affects your marketing strategy. Most submissions are now via email or via CD portfolios. Now, postcards can be used as an intro, but in my opinion, it's far better to get a portfolio in front of someone than a picture postcard with one or two images. I mean, CDs are really cheap to produce these days, a few cents. However, I've read so many blogs by paranoid artists worrying about having their ideas stolen, even asking clients to sign non-disclosure forms before they'll even send them a CD. Now, in rare circumstances, this may be advisable. But if you're simply sending a CD of card designs or images to a well-established publisher or manufacturer to review, just simply send 72 DPI images at, say, 7x5 or 8x6. So they're not really printable. So don't make it difficult for clients to use you. They haven't got the time to start signing non-disclosure and entering into long conversations that you're worried and so on. And many of these publishers have been in business for years and years. So don't insult them by not trusting them at the outset to look at your portfolio. They do this every day. So as the internet allows any artist anywhere in the world to submit to a publisher, or an art director, they're obviously inundated with work. So, this is your best strategy. It's best to be concise, keep your work on target to their needs. In other words, look at what they buy and send the very best work you can that's targeted to their market. That's very, very essential. And the other key strategy is to keep producing fresh ideas. Don't keep trying to sell the same portfolio over and over and over again, or a selection of work that's not attracting interest. You know, look at what results you're getting. If you're not getting results, change your look. Do something different. I know it's unfortunately a bit of a numbers game, but that's simply the way it is these days. You've got to keep producing fresh ideas. Now, I'm going to go back and talk a little bit about this on-demand revolution, because this is becoming the new business model, particularly for the fine art industry. And it means publishers or self-published artists don't have to hold inventory. And clients can order in different sizes or custom sizes. They can choose whatever substrate, whether it be paper, canvas, varying degrees of finishes and textures. The prints can be gallery wrapped, varnished, glazed, some have special effects, or even be hand embellished to make them very individual. And it's a flexible new way of doing business, and I think this sector will see a good growth in the years ahead. And the traditional printing posters, where you print 2,000 plus, and this is for the publishers in this area, it's become less and less lucrative, particularly in the small sizes, as the big retailers demand such low prices to the point many publishers make so little profit that it's hardly worth selling. The artist's royalties are minimal. On 10 by 8, they can sell for as little as 28 cents. Your 10% is so minimal, they've got to sell tens of thousands for you to make any money. So many publishers simply still continue to do this to keep the turnover flowing, but many now are opening these new on-demand websites. So I see this as a key growth area in the fine art publishing industry. Now, the next thing I'm going to talk about is called buyer burnout. And this is a problem that many of the art directors are having in the industry. It's very tough to overcome, as some buyers get as many as 1,000 designs for every product they produce. That's rare, but some of them are getting 300 or 400. But, you know, one client said 1,000 designs for every product they produce. Now, that means that 999 are rejected and one is chosen. So that means often excellent designs get rejected simply because that particular slot or category has been filled. The key to staying successful is creating work which is in tune with the market. Now, this is easier said than done, but this goes back to researching the client and the styles they buy, as opposed to trying to sell them your own style of art, which may be miles away from what they're looking for. So keeping abreast of trends is very important in whatever category you're in. Very, very important thing to look at. I'll be a little bit later on, I'm going to talk about that a little bit more detail. But one of the things I want to cover, because I want to make sure I fit as much as I can in this talk, one of the questions I'm asked often is licensing shows. Are they worth it? Now, it costs around $5,000 to $8,000. I'm talking about $3,500 for the booth. You've got your travel costs, your hotel costs, et cetera, your display. I actually believe it's too expensive. And while a few companies and a few individuals may do well, I believe that most don't cover their expenses. So by visiting a trade show, you can get the catalogs, the names and addresses of potential clients. And even if you did exhibit, many of the art directors don't have much time these days, as they often only pay you a fleeting visit, as they flit around the 200 or 300 booths. So $5,000 could be much better spent creating a great presentation and mailing campaigns. I also found that shows took up weeks of time beforehand, preparing and trying to generate interest in mailing things. So I think that time could be better spent producing new work. Good work often finds a home. So unless you're enjoying a really good income from licensing already, I carefully examine the cost and the effectiveness of exhibiting. There is one show, however, which I would recommend. It's called the Craft and Hobby Show. And they've now got a licensing section. So you can go online, obviously, Craft and Hobby, and you'll find out where the shows are. It's around half the cost to exhibit, and they're just over $1,500 for a booth. And they also have tabletop presentations, which are very cheap. So if you're producing work for the scrapbook industry and related industries, you know, like rubber stamps and so on, that might be worthwhile. And there might be some spin-off things in there as well, stationery and so on. So I think you might be better off visiting, if you're in the fine art side, Art Expo, or the West Coast Art Show, which is on in Las Vegas next week, or go to the stationery show in New York and look for clients there that your work's suitable for greetings cards and paper products. And then there are gift shows all over America. So one of these shows might be very useful to visit just to get the catalog and find clients who you can then submit to after the show. Now, the gift shows are tougher to get in because they're trade shows. Keep a low profile if you do manage to get in and simply look for suitable companies. And don't try and sell your designs at these shows or you may be shown the door. And it also gives the industry a bad name. They don't want artists wandering around these gift trade shows trying to sell designs. And they're very, very much against it. Now I'm going to just finish off this little piece, and I'm going to go into some questions. But I want to talk about the importance of trends. I can't emphasize this aspect enough. It's a key factor now why most artists fail to sell. Because they do their own thing instead of fulfilling their clients' needs. Now, this one factor alone can mean the difference of a successful or a very lean year. There's a caveat here. At the high end of the fine art level, then sometimes an artist will break through with an original style or they'll find a niche market for their work, which simply takes off. But there's a point at which you have to look at what you're producing. And if you want to make a living, you have to look at what style or kinds of work actually are selling if you don't want to get rejected constantly. And so if you're getting rejection after rejection after rejection, you know, wake up, because basically people are telling you something. This is not what we're looking for. And so if you're trying to make money and you're trying to sort of make a living, the best way to make, I always tell artists this, look at what the clients are looking for and try and fulfill a need. It's an old, old, old saying. Fulfill the client's needs and you'll be successful. So basically, you know, I hope that sort of helped you with the changing face of the licensing industry. And now I want to sort of go on to some things that I think will be interesting for all of you, because there's some very, very good questions here. And we've got about 15 minutes, and I should be able to answer most of them. I'll read the question first so you know what it's about. This is from a professional photographer, I think. An acquaintance of me directed me to a site called redbubble.com. It's a site that advertises and sells prints of art and photographs online. It's open for anyone who wants to submit work, good or bad, although the work he reviewed was first rate. The company collects the money, makes the print from the high quality file, and sends them out, frames the art, ships it, and then pay the artist for the use of the images. So it sounds like licensing. My question is there ever a time, such as in this case, where signing up some of my images for this site might be detrimental to me later? Should I want to approach a different company to license my work? Very, very good question, because there are lots and lots and lots of these sites who are basically setting themselves up. They're basically print companies who basically produce the product, ship it, have a shopping cart where you can buy. But when you go onto these sites, I went onto redbubble.com. Now, I'm not saying anything against them. I'm just going to comment and give you my view of what I think is very relevant to what this site does. Looking at the art on that website, I think very, very little of it will actually sell. Comparatively very little. One of the things I don't like about sites like this is that anybody can download their work onto it. So it can be from really, really horrendously bad work to very indifferent work to mediocre work to pretty good work. But when you start to look at, is there any really, really good work on there? It's hard to find. So consequently, these sites, people visit them, they'll sell basically some work, but overall they're sites for people who really are can't sell their work into the mainstream. So the mainstream publishers demand work which is highly saleable and very marketable. These sites take on anything and everything. So in many ways it's pretty bad. Should it be detrimental later? It all depends. If you've sold a lot of work on it, then that's probably a good sign. I don't think it does that much harm in a way, but if a company came along and said they want to publish you, the first thing to do is take it off that site straight away. It's a good thing to do for publicity and maybe get some sales, but if you're serious about getting into the publishing industry, the thing to do is get a publisher to do it for you. They have huge marketing budgets. They know what work sells. And I say, if you're producing work which they keep rejecting, you've got to look at why. So you're really going to end up going onto these sites. And in general, and I'm saying this is a very generalization, is most work doesn't sell. Okay, second question. When considering fine art publishing, is it unwise to take a 2-year gamble with a company new in the art publishing business instead of trying to break into a more established publisher? It's a tough question, this, but it's very relevant. There are a lot of new companies coming into publishing all the time. How do you do your due diligence? One of the things, it's like, what's the background of the people who are running the publishing company? If they're a breakaway from a very well-established company and they've been in the business a long, long time, they've got contacts, they know who people are in the industry, and they've probably already got, you know, sort of a client list. So that company would be a better bet as a new company than someone just trying to break into the publishing industry who didn't know much about it. Those are the companies I would seriously avoid. And try and get into with a more established publisher. Now, one of the things about being with a new publishing company is that they're fresh and new, and if you're a new artist to them, you're going to get pushed because you're one of the key players in their publishing company because you're new. They're new, your artwork's new, they want to look after you, they want your work to sell, so they're going to be pushing a little bit harder. Because you'll be one of a fewer number of artists, you know, maybe 10 or 20 artists that they start with, as opposed to some of the bigger publishers who've maybe got 100, 200, or 300 artists. So you're a fish in a small pond, so you become a big fish. Whether or with a big publisher, you're a little fish in this big pond. So it can work both ways. It can be good and bad. And it all depends on the work you're producing, and it all depends on the new publisher that you find. So I hope that answers the question. Question number three. We've been invited by a Japanese company, Megapress, to submit work to be considered for calendars. The representative asked for large digital files to be used for the presentations. We checked with several artists here who had been involved, and they said it was a legitimate offer. They'd been very pleased with the results. Have you heard anything about this approach? It really feels like doing business on a handshake, sending large files and only getting paid when a calendar's been accepted. And yet the representative seemed quite straightforward, and the artist we spoke to spoke highly of the company. Now, in a way, you've got your answer already in the question. If it's a good company and everybody's happy with them, then why not? Why would you be reluctant to send the work? Firstly, it's a no-brainer. If they're saying they have to produce digital files because they've got to produce samples, they've got to print them. Without the digital files, they can't print the samples. Therefore, your work's not being accepted. Your work's not even in the ball game. So it's a no-brainer. If you want to work with this company, either supply the digital files or don't. Don't do business with them. You can't get a better recommendation than artists who worked with them, and they say this company's a good company. That's the best recommendation you can get. So what are you worried about? Why don't you trust them? Of course it's a handshake. You can send a letter, get them to drop a little note and sign it and say these are on consignment, and they have to let you know. Work out all the terms beforehand. Work out the percentage. Work out what royalties you possibly could get and say, of course. I mean, you're trying to do business. So don't make it difficult for these guys. You know, think of the guy at the company, a really nice company. They've been in business for years. They're working with lots of artists. They've got a great reputation. And you're, like, worried about doing business with them because they want your files. So without their files, they can't print them. So that's an easy question. This is an interesting one. I've been evaluating the pros and cons of spending at least $6,000 a year to have my work included on TODL. It's a trade-only design library, TODL.com. I would greatly appreciate any insight into this type of marketing presence. The artworks I would feature there are a series of nature's energy designs as open and limited edition G-clays. I'm also interested in licensing some of the work as textiles. Now, this TODL, I know of them. I don't deal with them because it's a design source for architects, interior designers, developers who want a resource of, it can be tables and chairs, it can be furniture, and all kinds of things that they use on their design projects. And this is really for hospitality and office projects. Maybe some residential, but a lot of it's sort of for the, and it's got a lot of very, very influential designers and architects who use the service. Now, to find out a bit more, I rang the company, and I also went on the website and talked to them for 10 minutes just to get, you know, the real skinny on them. Very nice people, and one of the key aspects to this spending $6,000 a year is, firstly, is the work suitable for this particular database? Now, I've gone on the website of this particular artist, and the answer is no, immediately. Keep your $6,000. It's not to do with your work's not good, but it's not really the type of work that these big interior design companies are going to be buying regularly. Most of it has got to be abstract work. A lot of it's to do with, environmental issues. Now, I know you've got nature in there, but a lot of the images you're producing aren't really suitable for this kind of very, very high-end database. I work with some of the people in the design business, and you have to really, really get to know what interior designers are looking for their projects. If it was a few hundred, I'd probably think twice about saying no, but $6,000, no way in hell should you be paying that kind of money to promote your work. You've got to sell a tremendous amount of work to actually get that money back. And perhaps the lady there would be very helpful, and if you showed her your work, she'd probably tell you the same thing. They don't really want work on that website that's not suitable for their database. I mean, you may end up with a very, very, very tiny selection, but in general, you don't want to be paying this kind of money to actually go into something like this. Now, there are other companies out there which you can use, and what you've got to do is do your research. But in general, I don't believe in spending vast amounts of money on advertising and putting your work into websites where you're paying vast amounts of money. I just don't believe it works. I actually think advertising, and a lot of people advertise in the licensing magazines. I mean, they'd be horrified at me saying this, but I just never found it pays off. What happens is you put an advert in, and you can't really get a grip on where it comes from, what happened. Are you getting any feedback from these adverts that you're putting in? I think that many artists who advertise, they probably do it with a show, a trade show, like the licensing show or Certex, and they probably place a small ad to back up that, exhibition space that they're going to take. And I don't think that's a bad idea, as long as you don't spend too much money. I always think that the best advertising you can do is really direct. Either direct mail with nice big postcards that show a lot of your work, or better still, email presentations or CD portfolio presentations, maybe along with the postcard so they can get a glimpse of, a printed sheet, so they get a glimpse when they open it and say, oh, this looks interesting, makes them want to put the CD into their computer. And if they've had 20 or 30 that day, you've got to realize that, clients are really inundated constantly with presentations. Make your presentations easy to open. Don't send huge files. I didn't mention this before. I had somebody the other day send me 10 megabyte files. I'm not talking about, 10 1-megabytes. 10 megabyte files in my email box. It basically almost crashed my computer trying to open these things, because in email campaigns, your email will only take up to about 10 or 15 anyway. Send JPEGs, about 200K. Then you can put 20 or 30 in one email, but not huge files. Very, very important. So keep your presentations, professional. Don't send elaborate slideshows. Just do JPEGs. We've got programs that are preview files. We just open it, click it, and look at them very, very fast. If it's one of these slideshows with music and, oh, my God, it takes like 10, 15 minutes to look at this, whereas JPEGs, I can do that in literally 1 minute flat. So I don't want to spend time looking at a presentation that takes 5 or 10 minutes. I just simply haven't got the time, and neither do clients.
Oh, so, thank you, Michael. I'm going to jump in here.
That's my last question, so
it's really interesting. Before we jump into our second guest, I just want to note that Michael Bungie Stanier yesterday was talking about artists presenting themselves in ways that were unique and different and out of the box. And I think the caveat here for artists is you have to know when and where to do that, because for a lot of these presentations, the people looking at them have seen so many that they don't want to spend time. They don't care about how you're presenting it. They care about what you are presenting. So you have to make that what very professional and very direct.
Absolutely.
And simple. So it's an interesting question. When do you distinguish yourself and how do you do that? And when do you just follow the traditional course that's laid out, because that's what's going to be easiest for the person you're working with?
A little thing is like putting a beautiful label on your CD instead of scrawling your name, on the CD.
There you go.
So you can't even read it. And you're looking, who the hell?
Right.
I get many CDs that don't have anything on the CD itself. So I take it out and think, who the hell does this belong to? There's not even a label on the actual CD.
It's amazing, isn't it? Those details, how important they are.
And those programs are like $15, $20 to buy a little CD program to print a label, which looks really professional.
So I have two questions that what I'm going to do is send them to you by email, and I want to post them on the forum because two things came up for me today, but we really don't have time right now.
Okay.
So thank you, Michael, so much for coming back again this year. You can find Michael's book, Art Licensing 101, on our new hot list of recommended books on the Inside Resource pages. And I'll send you any follow-up questions your way, okay?
Thank you.
Thank you. Enjoy the rest of your day, Michael.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye. If you have just joined us, you are on the seventh day of Smartest 2008 and the fifth and last day of our keynote presentations. We've just heard Michael Woodward, and next will be Jennifer Loudon, and we'll end with Eric Mazel.